Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Straight from the Source, streaming to you on the Heritage Radio Network studio. We're here in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn, New York. It's 3 p.m. Eastern Time, and we come to you this and every Wednesday afternoon. My name's Clay Gordon, and in the 20 years that I've been exploring my chocolate life, I visited cacao farms from Bolivia to Belize and beyond and spent time with farmers, cacao merchants, and some of the world's best chocolate makers and confectioners in the U.S. and in Europe. Straight from the Source is inspired by the people I've met and what they've taught me. My guest this week is Jeff Shepard, founder and the leader of a chocolate flock, I suppose you'd call it, in Central Point, Oregon, the award-winning Lily Bell Farms. Today we're going to be talking about how craft artisan chocolate business can compete against big chocolate and not only survive, but thrive and prosper. Hey, welcome, Jeff.
Hello, Clay. Thank you.
You know, it's my pleasure to have you here this afternoon. I've been reading your website. LilyBellFarms.com, and it says that all your chocolates are made with a proprietary blend of organic couverture. I'm not going to ask you what they are. I'm not going to ask you to spill the secrets today, but that you explore equitable trade sources from around the world, from around the globe, whose commitment to organic, sustainable agriculture equals your own. So what does that mean for people who don't really understand the way chocolate and confectionery is made?
Well, okay. Well, as you know, but maybe your listeners don't, the majority of the cocoa beans on the planet are not farmed organically. Considering 60% of the world's cocoa comes out of the Ivory Coast and Ghana and places like that, those countries still are able to use chemical pesticides and chemical fertilizers that are banned in the United States, like DDT and things like that. We try to source our chocolate and our cocoa from farms that have decided to grow it more naturally, you know, not use chemical fertilizers and pesticides, because what you put on your food ends up in your food. And because I own a 2-acre certified organic farm here, it just made sense for me to source organic chocolate, which I can tell you has been a struggle for 10 years.
You know, I can imagine. Now, I know a little bit about your history. You didn't start off to become either an organic farmer or a confectioner and chocolate maker, did you?
Oh, heavens no. No, no, no. This is late in life, my friend. I mean, I was a chef, okay? I worked in the restaurant industry for about 25 years and successfully ran many restaurants and also owned my own catering company. And then I made this grand leap of moving from one of my homes in Hawaii to Oregon. And, of course, I had to figure out what to do with my time. I had to find something to do. I tried to go back into the restaurant business, but having owned a business in Hawaii, I was no longer employable. It's like once you own your own business, it's really hard to work for other people.
Right, and nobody wants to employ you because they think you're gunning for their job or something like that.
Right, or you're just going to stand around and try to tell them how to run their business,
right.
Which I'm really good at.
Telling other people how to run their business?
I convinced my wife to let me try to make some chocolates. Now, in between Hawaii and Oregon, we took a little recommissioning trip. We took about 5-6 weeks, and we went to Europe in between the islands and moving to Oregon. And it was my first time to Europe. And I was completely blown away by not just the food in general, you know, the old world food, all kinds of great stuff. But it seems like every city, every town you go to, you know, there's a boulangerie, there's a charcuterie, there's a cheesemonger, and then there were chocolatiers, there were chocolatiers in all these towns, and even small towns, and many across cities. And I was blown away. I was like, oh, how come we don't have chocolate shops like that in the United States?
And all of them doing, you know, pretty fabulous work, you have to admit.
Oh, absolutely. Right. I mean, stunning work. The thing that has inspired me most was a truffle that I bought And I do not remember the name of the shop. I have no idea. We bought some things. They were not in English, you know, the descriptions. I just said, oh, that's pretty. Let me buy that. And about 2 days later, I was on a train going to Paris somewhere, and I busted into this box that I bought, and I ate this truffle. And it took me a minute. I mean, I had to eat both of them. Barely could share them. And I realized that the flavor in the background, it was very subtle, but it was there. It was part of it. It was black pepper. And I thought, oh, my God, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. And it stuck with me. And when I decided to start my own business here in Oregon, I let my wife hand over a little bit of money out of our savings, and I go, I want to buy a little tiny tempering machine, and I want to make truffles and sell them at the farmer's market.
Right. So you had chocolate in the back of your mind when you started Lily Bell Farms. I noticed that you had this organic berry farm,
right.
And you were thinking about making jams and things like that, but also looking at incorporating things that you were making from the berries into the confections that you were making.
Absolutely right. That's exactly what I did. I was picking berries that first summer after I got the thing planted and it was growing really well. I was pulling anywhere from 25 to 30 flats a day out of this one patch, and that's a lot of raspberries, and you can only make so much jam, and I'm making jams, and I'm, you know, buying sugar, and I'm making jars, and I'm doing this, and I'm taking them to farmers markets, and I'm like, this is a lot of work, and I can only get like $6 for a jar of this jam, you know, $6-$8, something like that.
Right.
And then it occurred to me that, you know, there I did some exploration. I went, why don't I make chocolate truffles out of these raspberries? You know, let's use them in a ganache. Mm-hmm. And I can maximize them and get them to go a little further, you know, for the money.
Right.
And people liked them. You know, people liked my raspberry ganache. They thought that was really good. Right. And so, I did some exploration and figured out that there were molded chocolates, and I could take my preserves and put them right into a mold, mm-hmm. and charge considerably more for them by the ounce than I could by the jar.
So, is this part of the secret to the success of Lily Bell Farms, is that it's not just a chocolate business? There's this organic berry farm, and the two are somehow, you know, intimately connected with each other?
A little bit. I mean, it might be. It's also, I mean, I met you 10 years ago.
I was wondering, 2003, 2004, when you first sent me one of your earliest box of chocolates to get my opinion on.
Yeah, 2003.
Okay.
We had the Emerging Chocolatiers competition that year, right?
That's right, and you sent me a box in advance of then, absolutely.
Yeah, so and they were really primitive. I mean, I was still at my kitchen counter doing them at home, you know, still learning the ropes. I had no idea what I was doing, particularly. I knew how to blend cream in chocolate, you know, but that was about it.
But the whole issue of shelf life and how to make them stable and how to make them food safe and all that kind of stuff was part of the journey that was going to be coming forward.
Yes. Well, I was clueless.
Okay.
Let there be no doubt. I was. And I did not understand it by any stretch of the imagination, and marketing was not my strong point. So, maybe the fact, I mean, that was a good part of our story, you know, that we do have a farm, that we do live on the farm, that, you know, this started that way at the farm. I mean, mm-hmm. fast forwarding 10 years, you know, you've been here, I have a 5,000 square foot facility with, you know, 10 employees running around now 7 days a week. It's certainly grown exponentially. Right. And, of course, only like three of the things that we do still have fruit that we grow, because you can't grow everything. So part of it's that, and part of it is, you know, winning awards and continually striving for perfection. I think that's my downfall.
That's what gets you out of bed every morning, trying to make the perfect piece?
Right. I mean, that's our goal in the kitchen. I instill it in my people in the kitchen, is to try to make better chocolates today than you made the day before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no matter what it is, even if it's the 4,000th time you've made the same lavender caramel, make it better.
Right, that is. And I also know, because, you know, as you say, I visited there and I'm familiar with a lot of work, that one of the things you really strive to do, and actually this is something the state of Oregon does, is it makes it easy for Oregon businesses to purchase from other Oregon businesses, especially in the food world, that you incorporate a lot of ingredients that you get from other Oregon businesses in what it is that you're doing.
Absolutely.
You're right across the parking lot, as I remember, from Rogue River Creamery. Is that correct?
Yes. The Rogue Creamery, world-famous blue cheese manufacturer, we share a parking lot. And they were one of my first customers. I mean, even when I was still at the farmer's market, these two guys who had bought this 75-year-old, you know, cheese place that was basically a handshake deal with the cheesemaker because he was old and wanted to retire, they had just purchased that cheese factory when I was still at the farmer's market. They were still learning how to make blue cheese while I was learning how to make chocolate. And they were my very first wholesale customer. They're like, it's got to be really hard to sell chocolates out of an ice chest in a 100-degree parking lot. And I went, yeah, it's impossible. And they're like, well, if you put them in a pretty package with a legal label, we could sell them in our store. You could give us a wholesale price. And I went, well, there's a thought. Mm-hmm. Get me out of the parking lot. And those guys are, and they make some of the best blue cheeses. So, of course, you know, I walk across the parking lot to get blue cheese to make a blue cheese truffle. Of course.
Right.
You know, and the same with the hazelnuts. I know the farmer up north in McMinnville, you know, and I buy my hazelnuts from this guy I know, you know.
And also Rogue Brewery?
Rogue Brewery, we've done some work with them. We've certainly made some beer caramels using their stuff. There's more breweries here than ever now. So I've made caramels with Rogue Brewery. I've made ganaches with a local porter. Mm-hmm. This guy is producing here in Medford.
Mm-hmm.
Love doing beer and chocolate pairings. I know you're a fan of those, too.
I just got back from the Chicago Fine Chocolate Festival, where I did a series of six presentations over 3 days, beer and chocolate pairings, that were just, you know, phenomenal. We had some
excellent.
We had some great beers. If you're a beer fan, and do you know the Lindemann's Faro? I don't know if it's
It's a
lambic style beer, but it's made with Belgian candy sugar rather than fruit over the top of it, which is really quite remarkable. And then the Eyinger Celebrator Double Bock, which was just killer, as you might imagine.
I know this. Love that beer.
Those are fabulous things.
Good. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm always looking for the perfect combination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm always adventuring off to do strange things. A lot of people say, oh, you're the guy that thinks completely out of the chocolate box because
mm-hmm.
you actually made a success out of doing blue cheese truffles. And I'm like, well, yeah, but it took 5 months of playing with blue cheese and chocolate to make one that's palatable.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you can't just mix up blue cheese and a ganache because I assure you it will not be good.
Well, and if you're actually also not very careful, overnight it will explode.
Yeah, anything can happen. I mean, it's they'll go moldy if you don't get it right. You got to pasteurize the
cheese. It's already moldy, I suppose, right?
And you have to kill that. You have to kill the penicillin, or you're doomed.
Right. Interesting thought. I hadn't quite thought about it that way. So, you're this relatively small guy in the almost the middle of nowhere in Central Oregon. I mean, you're a couple of hours south of Eugene, you're north of Ashland, Klamath Falls area. So, you know, how is it that somebody like you can compete or on a national scale with people who've been in business for much longer than you are and who've got, big public pockets behind them? You know, what's the secret to, you know, what it is that you do and your success? I mean, over the last 10 years.
You know, I have to pinch myself sometimes. I mean, 10 years I've been going at this.
Mm-hmm.
And we are successful, and we're growing, you know. And one of it is to be able to spot what works and what doesn't work. I mean, you know, when I was learning the ropes and I was out there and when I was going to the New York Chocolate Show, you know, I would show up with a palette full of ganaches because that's what I was doing, you know, some fruit things and other things. But I didn't have a very broad spectrum of products. So I was banking on just doing a fancy chocolate, which is fine, except that, you know, wholesale accounts won't take them mm-hmm. because they have a very, very short shelf life. Mm-hmm. So my wholesale market was, you know, shot.
Okay.
And what I had to do was come up with products that would have shelf stability and make it viable to put it in the marketplace. You know, and we still do everything by hand. I mean, I sell a lot of bars now. We have probably 12 bars in our arsenal, and we wholesale every one of them, but we still mold them by hand and wrap them by hand. I don't have an auto Hansel. I don't have a one-shot depositing machine. Right. I don't even have a sell me.
So for the people who aren't versed in chocolate industry lingo, an auto Hansel and a one-shot and a sell me are?
They are automated equipment. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the job that I have two people doing, one person can run an auto Hansel bar wrapping machine. It'll do 5,000 bars an hour
mm-hmm.
if you feed it. You know, just keep feeding it, and it'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sits there and wraps them. It wraps them in foil, and it wraps them in paper, and it's automated, and it goes. They're very expensive.
Right.
And same with a one-shot machine. They're one-shot depositing machines. You put your mold in there. You have your mixture of chocolate and whatever, say a caramelized almond bar. You have your almonds chopped up to the right size, and you pour that mixture in the machine, and it just goes, and it automatically fills the molds.
Mm-hmm.
and it goes into a cooling tunnel automatically, and it rotates around that cooling tunnel until they're ready to pop out. Mm. And then they come out the end of the mold, and the bars are done.
Right. So do you find that there is any kind of pushback? I mean, in some places, the notion of, you know, handmade, people are very careful to say we don't use any machinery. But in chocolate, that's almost impossible. I mean, you do need to use some machine or some kind of tempering machine or something like that. But is how much of that is, you know, part of what it is that Lily Bell is and does?
It might very well be one of the big selling factors that we do hand pour every bar. I mean, we hand mold them, you know, we hand knock them out, we hand wrap them in foil, and another person hand wraps them in paper. It's part of the charm. The name of my company is Lily Bell Farms Handmade Chocolates. Now, as I grew, of course, I have to have a melter that can handle the capacity. So you have to have chocolate meltings. You can't just use a double boiler to churn out 20 tons of chocolate a year, you know.
Wow.
And same with tempering machines. Mm-hmm. You know, we have tempering machines. We temper 40, 50 pounds of chocolate at a time to do a batch of something. So, of course, I have machinery that will temper, mm-hmm. you know. But, I mean, that's just, I don't even think those are compromises. That's just the only way to do it.
Right. Everything does have that handmade touch. Whereas, for example, if you were using a one-shot depositing machine, what you'd be doing is you'd be filling machine, and maybe there'd be some handwork at the end, pulling the pieces out of the mold or something like that. But
right.
you'd lose that connection.
There'd be one person at the end of the line flipping the mold over, hitting it with a mallet, and then the bars go down the conveyor belt to the person waiting for them at the wrapping machine. You know, I mean, I've seen the factories that do that. Sure, mm-hmm. there's still people there. You know,
but they're essentially
chocolate without people.
But they're machine feeders more than anything else.
Yeah, the machine. The guy that works for me now, my kitchen manager, he did that. He worked for Harry and David for 5 years, which is a large local employer, mm-hmm. and he also worked for Endangered Species.
Ah, okay.
He was the plant manager at Endangered Species because that company got a start here in Southern Oregon, and he knew how to run large industrial equipment. You know, 50,000-pound melters and automatic tempering machines, and it's all warm-piped, you know.
Uh-huh.
He was a machinist. Mm-hmm. Not a chocolatier.
Right.
Although he knew what the digital readout was of tempered chocolate, but he'd never seen it, you know. He never touched it.
Right.
So, you know, I had to retrain him. I mean, he had the basic knowledge to keep what equipment I have running, but is learning chocolate, I taught him from scratch. I taught him how to temper on a marble slab. I do it for everybody that starts here. Here's how you temper it by hand.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can use the little 10-pound machine, you know, the ChocoVision machine.
Right.
And learn how to seed in the back. And now you can use the bigger machine, yeah. you know. So, I mean, I still try to instill that in people. I mean, all of our batches are made really small. We're mm-hmm. doing hazelnut buttercreams for a client right now. And, you know, we can only do 180 pieces at a time. Mm-hmm. But they ordered 1,600.
Ouch.
So we're going to do that batch over and over and over. I don't have enough molds.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And if it's just a one client, one time thing, I'm not going to invest the money to buy more molds.
Right.
We'll just do it over and over again. So every batch is exactly the same.
That is certainly the hope. But every batch is exactly the same, but everything has got that handmade finish. Hey, Jeff, we're going to take a short break.
Okay.
We're talking with Jeff Shepard of Lily Bell Farms, and when we return to Straight from the Source on Heritage Radio Network, we're going to learn more about what it takes to be a successful craft chocolate business these days.
You're listening to Kursk by Controller on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
See no light, no religion, I see no light. My last thoughts as they come to me are only pictures of you. The pain's not dying, it's knowing I will never again see you.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, 5 generations, 145 years. a full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
Welcome back to Straight from the Source on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Clay Gordon, creator and moderator of thechocolatelife.com and author of the IACP finalist book, Discover Chocolate. Today, I'm talking with Jeff Shepherd of Lilybell Farms in Central Point, Oregon. So, Jeff, why did you decide that it was important to start making your own chocolate from the bean?
Ah, well, that's a good question. I mean, after all the years of buying chocolate from various purveyors and, you know, testing every chocolate I could get my hands on and studying chocolate and being immersed in chocolate and then kind of watching what was going on the side over there, I mean, knowing people in the industry, you know, getting to know Art at Amano and watching the process of people who made American manufactured chocolate, right? I knew the people at Theo and watched them build that big factory, and I was there when they had all their equipment delivered, and I went, that's huge!
Right.
That's enormous! Mm-hmm. I'll never do that. And then the technology downscaled. I mean, there's some products out there that allowed people to make craft chocolate. And I thought, well, I want to try that. It can't be brain surgery. I'm gonna try this.
Well, was it in fact harder than it looked?
It's much harder than it looks. I mean, anybody can do it. I mean, okay, you can take some cocoa beans and you can burn them, and then you can shell them, and you can stick them in a Cuisinart if you want, or through a Champion juicer and then into a Cuisinart, and you're gonna make something that resembles chocolate.
Right.
But you know, I mean, I have my favorites out there of like the what I call the global manufacturers, the big guys. The big dogs.
Okay.
You know, Yes, Felkland.
Okay.
I think Felkland makes some of the finest chocolate on the planet Earth. You know, so when I set out to make a chocolate, my goal is to make chocolate as good as Felkland, which I know I can't do, you know, but that's my target.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's like Cru Sauvage or the Elevicia or, you know, some of the stuff they do is just brilliant in flavor and complexity and everything you want in a chocolate. And that's what I'm shooting for. You know, it's like, okay, I know what they can do. Now let's see what I can do.
Right.
And how can I meet in the middle somewhere based on the size and scale of my equipment?
Right. And so just for our listeners at home, Felkland is based in Switzerland.
Yes.
They're a 100-year-old family-owned business. They've been making chocolate now for 50 years and started a Grand Cru line in the late 1990s. The Cru Sauvage you're talking about is made from beans that are harvested wild. They're wild harvested. In the Beni region of Bolivia, near the Brazilian border. And I just learned from Volker Lehmann, who runs the Hacienda Tranquilidad, which is where those beans come from, is that starting with next year, I believe, there's going to be a Fair Wild certification on those beans, which
Excellent.
Is quite interesting. And the Hacienda Elvesia is from the Dominican Republic. It's a 100-year-old or 200-year-old farm on the Dominican Republic, which was founded by some Swiss emigrants. And the connection, obviously, between Elvesia, which is Spanish for Switzerland, and a Swiss chocolate company makes a great deal of sense. So you're buying chocolate from a number of different places. You're making the chocolate. What's the chocolate bar that you make from the bean that you personally are proudest of?
Perfect Illusion.
Perfect Illusion. Tell us more about what Perfect Illusion is and what it's all about.
Okay, I'm getting beans. I mean, as I grew into this, and of course, you know, I already had a reputation in the industry for better or for worse or whatever, but people know who I am,
right.
You know, so manufacturers know who I am. And then as I delved into this bean to bar thing, people are like, oh, he's doing that now? And then, you know, I did the national trade shows and people have met me, and then pretty soon I started getting samples of beans from various places. And one of the samples that I got samples of three different beans from Sepi Cafe, which is located in Peru, and they're a lovely farmers cooperative down there. And as I was experimenting and learning how to do this, they sent me all three of their beans and said, oh, they have lots of clients in the United States. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm not going to be a big one. You know, I don't use a lot here. But they were really easy to work with. And one of the beans they sent me was this, they call it Gran Blanco, because, you know, 40 to 60% of the beans in the sack are white
yeah.
Criollo beans,
mm-hmm.
you know, this weird heirloom variety cacao that's kind of white when it's fermented and done. Mm-hmm. And I liked them. I thought they were incredibly fruity. You know, I did one test batch. I got like 10 pounds from them. They sent me a 10-pound test batch. I thought, and we nailed it the first time. I roasted them just right. I treated them like little babies. And I roasted these things, and I ground them, and I made a batch of chocolate, and it blew my mind. I was like, this is what I'm looking for. This is really good. Because it tastes like I added fruit to it. People who eat it say, oh, it's got raspberries in it. Oh, no, it has cherries in it. No, that's pomegranate. No, that's just right. Cocoa beans and sugar. Right. You know, roasted to perfection. One of the very first slabs I made of it, I sent to Gary Guittard down in San Francisco, mm-hmm. whom I met many times, and he called me and said, who taught you how to roast beans? Because that's amazing. So I got a little bit of validation there. It was like, you know, handing in a paper to the teacher, and he's like patting you on the head, going, right. "Good job."
Right. And Gary is a really good flavor guy. I must
right.
admit. I mean, most people may know Guittard. I think he's still the oldest family-owned chocolate maker in the United States.
Yes, it is.
Since the 1860s. You know, Gary is what, the fourth or fifth generation mm-hmm. owner of the company, and he's been immersed literally in chocolate since a very, very young.
Yeah.
Very young age, and when it comes to, you know,